Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. Our guest this evening is David Redden. He's the vice chairman of Sotheby's New York. He's been with Sotheby's since he was a young man, probably freshly out of diapers, since 1974. Good evening, David.
Good evening.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into this business, and what exactly still keeps you interested.
Well, Sotheby's is my first job. I am a really bad example for anybody else who comes to work here because they may spend the rest of their life here. I certainly have. 41 years have gone by very quickly. I came here because I was a collector myself. I love collecting. I understand why people collect, because I do it myself. When I was 10 years old, I had a museum. It wasn't a very grand museum, but it was my own little museum. And I decided I work at Sotheby's with the idea of learning how to collect better. And then I became completely and totally captivated, and I couldn't leave.
Now, I understand that you are also an auctioneer. So you know what the emotion of getting the price, and tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I am the longest serving auctioneer at Sotheby's worldwide. I've been an auctioneer for 40 years. I became an auctioneer about a year after I began at Sotheby's. I've auctioned every kind of object that Sotheby's sells. I've been the auctioneer, for example, for Judaica since the early 1980s. A very long time indeed, and it's, I have to say, when a sale does well, it's one of the most wonderful things in the world to be doing. If a sale doesn't do well, it's not so much fun. But a sale that does well, it just feels, you know, you're on top of the world, and it's as though you're singing, quite frankly. It's wonderful.
I am sure that, like in every auction, sometimes the highest price offered is sometimes too low, sometimes prices go up so high that even in the most optimistic way, you never expected it.
Perfectly true. There are moments when the room goes dead, but the auctioneer has to carry on. You can't feel, you're not allowed to feel depressed. You're not allowed to feel any anxiety. You just keep on going. But there are also times when the room just becomes so alive, and there are bids coming from everywhere. And suddenly, you know, you're experiencing an extraordinarily emotional high. It really can be thrilling, really thrilling. You know, it's thrilling for the audience. It's really thrilling for the auctioneer.
Of course, because in a way, it's your baby. You're selling it.
It really is. Yes. I mean, and you know, one takes it really quite personally. One is engaged, obviously, with the property that one's selling. But it's more than that. You're also representing the sellers. They're real people, you know, standing behind every object that gets sold. And, you know, in some cases, they're depending upon the sale of those objects to continue their lives. So you really take it very seriously.
I grew up in South America, and in Uruguay. And I remember sometimes going with my father to some of the art auctions. And most of the people there were not the collectors. Most of the people there were dealers. Is it still the case today?
Times have changed enormously. Once upon a time, yes. The auction rooms were primarily filled with professional dealers, antique store owners, and what have you. It's not true anymore. Private collectors come directly to the auction rooms, and it makes it much more lively, and it's really makes it more exciting. You have to be more attuned to the fact that people in the room aren't necessarily used to auctions. Sometimes they're new, and you sort of give people time to react and move too quickly. But it's much more fun having the room filled with, you know, collectors. Dealers are still very important. They and they represent, particularly in the book world, and sometimes in the world of Judaica, they will represent important clients. But great clients will now mostly bid for themselves. The one thing that has changed, interestingly, over the years is that important clients will not necessarily be in the auction room. They will be bidding on the telephone and now increasingly online, but they don't necessarily feel they have to come to the auction room. And that I regret. I like seeing them there. But the fact is, that bidders now in our major sales come from all over the world. And so one can't really expect them to always be in New York or wherever else the auction is taking place.
Although I would imagine that the electricity in the room is, you know, nothing like it, incomparable.
The electricity in the room can be absolutely fascinating and electrifying. You know, it is really when the sales come together, when the bidders come together, when the property is great, yes, the electricity is extraordinary.
Sotheby's has been around since, I believe, 1744.
Yes.
Obviously, things have changed tremendously since those days. But the basic objects that are being auctioned, have they changed also, or are they just more a modernization of the same?
It's a modernization of what has been sold before. I have to say that over the years I've been at Sotheby's, there have been remarkable changes in the art market. I think, you know, the most obvious and terribly apparent nowadays is the extraordinary interest in contemporary art, contemporary paintings. You know, when I started, the most valuable objects in the world at auction were really impressionist paintings. Mm-hmm. They're still extremely valuable. There are less of them available than there used to be because so many have gone into museums. But the truly expensive works of art now are often modern and contemporary paintings. And, of course, the supply, particularly contemporary paintings, is fairly inexhaustible.
Of course.
And what's remarkable, too, is that, you know, in our world, it's now about 50% of the value of all the objects we sell are really contemporary paintings.
Wow. And that's in the art auctions or in general?
In general, for all auctions.
I was looking yesterday at the Latin American exhibit, and it was remarkable how it has changed since the days when I lived in Uruguay. I left Uruguay in 1962, and the things that I see both at this exhibit, when I see it live, and in magazines, tastes have turned around completely. It's not the same at all. It's hard to believe that since 1962 till now, for God's sake, I'm no youngster, but I'm not that old either. How did things change?
Things have changed. You know, the art market as a whole has grown and grown and grown over the years. But within the art market, there are things that have become completely fashionable and things that have become a little less fashionable. You know, I sort of think of the extraordinary value that one can find today in, for example, 18th century English and American furniture, which used to be incredibly pricey, not so pricey anymore. I mean, there are many areas that have become more affordable, comparatively speaking, than they used to be, or the prices have been relatively stable. Other areas, such as contemporary paintings, where the prices have skyrocketed. I have to say one area that's been really quite stable, but the prices have gone up continuously, but in a way that's not out of line with what goes on in the rest of the world, is Judaica. Judaica has been a steady market, which makes it much easier to tell clients what to expect, because one knows where the market's going. It's not as though everything is doubling every 2 years.
What I find interesting about Judaica is I was told that not only Jews buy it. Is that true?
Oh, Judaica is particularly important for institutions. Institutions they want to have important collections of particularly Hebrew books and manuscripts. They're important for scholarship. They're important to represent a great culture. So I would say that the important buyers outside of the Jewish world are really major institutions around the world.
When you say around the world, can you give us some examples of places where one would not expect particularly a huge amount of Jews?
Well, I can tell you where the greatest collections of Hebrew books and manuscripts are in the world today. The British Library, mm-hmm. one of the truly greatest collections.
Absolutely.
The Bodleian at Oxford University.
Yes, yes.
The Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, fantastic collection. And then obviously the JTS here in New York, fantastic collection. And now building a great collection, the National Library of Israel, which is extraordinary. But there are collections in Italy, for example, which are very important. There are smaller collections at the great universities of America. All of them would be trying to put together important Hebrew books and manuscript collections. You know, the University of Pennsylvania, I sort of single out as the University of Chicago is interested. I know Stanford is, Harvard and Yale. They really are collections all over the place, certainly in this country, but also in elsewhere around the world, very much so. Collections in Sydney, Australia, and places like that.
Which brings us, of course, to the discussing the auction on the December 22nd of 12 items of the Valmadonna Trust Library. Now, the Valmadonna Trust Library is made up of 11,000 items between books and manuscripts. I understand that in 2009, Sotheby's held a huge, huge exhibit that attracted a lot of attention. But let's face it, when you guys have an exhibit, it's always a few days prior to the auction. What happened?
The idea was not to have an auction. The idea was to, we'd been asked by the trustees of the Valmadonna Trust Library to look for a single buyer for the entire library with some restrictions. I mean, the buyer needed to essentially promise that they would keep the library together, that they would allow access to scholars and the public to view the library. I think the goal really was to find an institutional home for the library. But in order to start that process off, I decided to put together an exhibition of the entire library. You know, this is unusual. When you have exhibitions of books and manuscripts at, you know, at libraries around the world, you might show a few dozen or maybe even a few hundred items, but that's it. You don't show thousands of items. And to actually have an exhibition that involved many, many thousands of items was highly unusual. But I thought we could do it in a way that would be exciting. You know, books, because when you do that, you're not really going to show the books open. You're not going to show, you can't show 11,000 books
of
open
course.
Up. Does it take too much room? So what we did is we devised an exhibition that, on the one hand, in a great big room with shelves that went up to the ceilings, which were 19 feet high, we arranged most of the books with either their spines out or maybe they'd be turned so you could see a front cover. A few would be open so you could see maybe an illustration inside one of the books or at least open to see the pages, but we organized it, which is the way in which the Valmadonna Library was always organized. We organized it by where the books were produced. So it became, in a sense, the geography of the Jewish people. It was really extraordinary, and we put labels showing where all the books had come from, Krakow, or Livorno, or Roma, or Venice, or Frankfurt, or wherever, Amsterdam, and from many, many small villages and towns in Russia and Eastern Europe, in the Middle East, in North Africa, and even India and China. The library focused on Europe, North Africa, and Asia, not so much on North and South America at all. North and South America, not part of it. And funnily enough, to a lesser extent, on Britain, although it had some of the greatest treasures imaginable from Britain. So we organized one room showing the geographical, extraordinary geographical dispersion of the Jews and where the books had come from. And then other rooms, large rooms also, we organized so that they, in cases, books were open so you could look at the books quite easily. And so we filled, I suppose, about 10 or 15,000 square feet with material, more like 15,000 square feet. And people went round these rooms, and it was really a sort of a revelation for them because they said, but that's where my grandmother came from, and that's where my great-grandfather came from. And it was really a sort of a recognition of their stories and the fact that these extraordinary books survived from often villages and small towns where these where the viewers had their families had come from originally. It was very moving. The word of mouth spread about the exhibition. It wasn't advertised, but it became a sensation. And by the end of the exhibition, we had 3,000 people a day going through the exhibition. We had to set up stanchions on the street outside our building because the crowds were too much. Even though we had an enormous amount of space that we were devoting to the exhibition, the crowds were just too much. And so people had to line up. And this is February. I mean, this wasn't exactly, you know, a warm time of year, but they did. And it was so extraordinary watching this happen. We had busloads of yeshiva boys would come. And, you know, the word spread in the sort of... In the most amazing way. I suppose it was early social media, in a sense. Well,
right.
Not that early, but still social media. And then rabbis were telling their congregations that they really had to come. I remember there was one extraordinary woman who came every single day. The exhibition was up every day. And she'd come with a new companion every time she came. She was 100 years old.
Wow.
It was amazing. And Jack Lunzer, who was the custodian of the collection, the man who primarily put it together.
He's the one who started it, no?
He's the one who, well, didn't, his father-in-law began it as a sort of colonel of the collection, but he built it into the grand collection it is today. He was there at the exhibition, and he was treated like a rock star, an absolute rock star. And one day, I was down in the lobby as he was coming in the morning, and he said, David, I can't go upstairs because the exhibition is up on our 10th floor galleries, which are our grandest galleries. And I said, Jack, why can't you go upstairs? And he said, I don't have a pen. I said, well, why does that matter? And he said, because I can't sign the autographs. People coming up to him nonstop asking him to inscribe. We had a brochure for the exhibition to inscribe the brochure. It was for him. It was, I think, the ultimate vindication of the work he'd done. I mean, there was no question that others appreciated what he'd done. Anyway, it was an extraordinary moment. Great pleasure to organize. And I think for the people who saw the exhibition, extremely moving.
A year later, I happened to be visiting one of the exhibits, and I found a small room where you had some of the books. At the time, there was one that was open right up front, and that was one of the volumes of the Bamberg Talmud, which is the crown royal of this particular... Can you explain something about it?
Of course. Yes, I mean, the crown jewel of the Valmadonna collection is the Bamberg Talmud. I would say it's not the essence of the collection. The essence of the collection really is the depth with which it was collected. So that what the goal was to collect sort of every early imprint from every town and village, so that there are 1,500 volumes from Venice, there may be 1,000 from Livorno, because the idea was really in depth, collecting everything that could be from the earliest days of printing, the 15th century, and there are about 70 or 80 incunables, that is, books printed at the beginning, the cradle of printing before 1501, but then collecting all the 16th century imprints and the 17th century imprints and 18th, and then in certain places where printing was much later, Hebrew printing such as Jerusalem or particularly in Shanghai or Bombay, even 20th century imprints. So that really was the essence, to have this extraordinary depth. But within all that, there were a certain number of extraordinary objects of great value, singly in their own right, and the Bamberg Talmud is really the most valuable one of them all. It's the first printing of the Talmud, done over a number of years, many years, at the beginning of the 16th century in Venice by a printer named Daniel Bamberg. You know, the Talmud is not a small book. In the case of the Valmadonna Bamberg Talmud, it's divided into 8 volumes. But what makes this, first of all, having a complete Bamberg Talmud from the 16th century is very rare. There are only about 12 that survive and only 2 in private hands. But what makes this copy particularly extraordinary is its story and also its unbelievable freshness, its preservation. It was ordered by an Oxford professor in the early 16th century, directly from Daniel Bamberg. So the pages, unbound or loosely bound, would have been sent to England, where the professor had them bound rather beautifully in Britain at the time. So they're
in a beautiful binding. Leather, actually.
Yes, beautiful, beautiful binding. And then when he died, he bequeathed his Bomberg Talmud to Westminster Abbey, where it sat in that library for about 450 years.
And it looks in perfect condition, like it was hardly ever opened.
Well, you know, it was a Christian library, and it probably was hardly ever opened, in fact. It was, in a way, a perfect place to keep it pristine, absolutely pristine. And then Jack Lunzer, the organizer of the library, had heard about this extraordinary copy of the Talmud and had coveted it enormously for years. And then he came up with a fabulously clever idea. Because, you know, you just don't go to Westminster Abbey and say, I'd like to buy that lot out.
Right,
they're not going to sell it. He was able to acquire the medieval charter for Westminster Abbey. And so he went to Westminster Abbey and said, look, I have this charter. Would you swap it for the Bomberg Talmud? You don't need the Talmud, but you'd like the charter. And they said yes. And that's how he got it, in 1980. That's he who was able to do that. I must say, I've since heard from Westminster Abbey, and they've said, oh, we'd never do that today.
They finally figured out the price.
Right.
One thing that I find fascinating, you said it was originally ordered by a professor at Oxford.
Yes.
Must have been very, very wealthy to be able to afford something like that. The prices of books must have been prohibitive to the average man.
Well, particularly something like the Bomberg Talmud, because it was a massive production. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a small little book. This is
right.
Massive. Yes, it would have been quite expensive. And in fact, in our catalog, I think we've done some interesting sort of price comparisons of what these things would have cost when they were produced. A lot of money. Yes, I mean he would have been wealthy. It would have required that, but thank goodness he was able to do it.
Of course.
And of course, I mean, more copies, only 12 survive today of that early Bomberg printing. There would have been many more, but of course, so many books were destroyed over the centuries. And in fact, starting in the mid-16th century, in 1550, there's a whole extraordinary effort to try and eradicate things like the Talmud.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been illegal to own a Talmud, so many of them were destroyed then. Some of the tractates, the individual chapters of the Talmud from Bomberg survive, so one can find those individually in auctions and elsewhere. But to have the entire extraordinary book is a real achievement.
What I found particularly interesting is that unlike contemporary copies, today's copies of the Talmud, the commentaries on the side end in points, in an inverted mountain at the end or an actual mountain at the beginning. Nobody does that today. And yet I find it makes the page itself look like a work of art.
You're so right, because the layout of the text is very creative, and it's actually fascinating to look at, it just in itself. I mean, and it's beautiful. I mean, the Venetian printing in the early 15th century, it was really beautiful. I mean, they had perfected the art. It was one of the great printing centers in Europe. And the Bomberg Talmud is the greatest production that they produced. I mean, they certainly produced, you know, fabulous things. The first time Aristotle was ever printed was in Venice. The first time so many other of the great classics were printed, it was all in Venice. And in a way, it made total sense. The first time the Talmud was printed, it was printed in Venice.
What I found interesting is that Daniel Bomberg was not a Jew, because
right.
Jews were not allowed to own printing houses, and yet he employed a lot of Jewish scholars, not just for the Talmud, but also for the Pentateuch and other Jewish books. For example, the whole Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. He also did an incredibly creative job in the layout. And the fonts are absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, it's a great work of art. But it really required a large group of people to produce.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, in a sense, he had this enormous advisory panel of rabbis and scholars to work on it. And I think all of them must have felt they were doing something that was culturally very important. And because the level of art and and scholarship is enormous, and it's become the basis for the printed Talmud ever since.
Of course.
Also interesting is that at the time, a Jews called Lashon Kodesh, the holy language, was not just spoken by Jews, by Jewish scholars, but the intelligentsia around the world also spoke that.
Well, if you try to understand the Bible, particularly from a scholarly point of view, you need to know Hebrew, and you need to know Greek, and that
Absolutely.
Was essential. So, you know, so having a Hebrew Bible or even a Hebrew Talmud in a scholarly setting was completely appropriate. We should note that not only is this sort of the crown jewel, although there are other crown jewels too, but this is of the collection. It's extremely valuable, and our estimate going into the sale in December is $5 million to $7 million. You know, that alone is the highest estimate ever placed on a piece of Judaica at auction. So extremely likely this will set, almost certainly will set, a new record for Judaica.
What was the prior record for Judaica?
Well, around $4 million or so. You know, we, in the Steinhardt sale a couple of years ago, we had...
Yes, you had the Maimonides code.
Right, and that was estimated for around $4 to $5 million, but it never got sold at auction. Before the sale, it was sold privately to, jointly, to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Israel National Library.
Right.
And I believe that they bought it for about $6.5 million, something like that.
The number was never revealed.
Oh.
It was sold privately.
But I'm sure it must have been.
A case like that must have been over the estimate.
It was sold for a lot of money. But I think in reality also, in that case, the consignor to the auction, Michael Steinhardt, also, it wasn't just a question of the money. It was where it was going that was important to him. And so it was going to two institutions where it would be given a real platform and looked after extraordinarily well and be available to scholars and thousands of people.
What are some of the other items that will also be featured?
Well, we've got in this first sale, as I said, it's only 12 items, but they are 12 treasures. It's the Bomberg Talmud. Is the only printed item in the sale. All the others are manuscripts, basically medieval manuscripts. There are some later ones. One of the most extraordinary is it's a Pentateuch, it's a Hebrew Bible from England, written in 1189, and it is the only surviving dated Hebrew manuscript from before the expulsion of the Jews in 1290. So, it's not only is an astonishing survival, but it really is a witness to the Jewish communities in England. And in a way, one of the reasons it can be sold now is because of the expulsion. If it had stayed in England, it would never have been given an export license to come to America. It would have been held there. But you know, when the Jews left England, they obviously took their books with them, including this. And so this, in fact, was found on the continent, and it was bought outside of England and therefore could easily then be exported to America for sale here. It's a beautiful object. It was chosen, interestingly enough, by Jewish organizations in Britain to represent Judaism at a special exhibition at Lambeth Palace, organized by the Archbishop of Canterbury, to celebrate Queen Elizabeth II's Diamond Jubilee. And what the Archbishop of Canterbury had asked all the great faiths represented in Britain to find one single object that represented the faiths, now, whether it's Christianity or Judaism. And the object chosen was this extraordinary Bible. It was over here in America, and we were asked if we could bring it back to London for this special exhibition, which we said happily we would. And there's a wonderful picture of Queen Elizabeth II looking at this Bible.
Some of the other items I noticed, you have a women's prayer book.
Well, we have two small prayer books. They're miniatures. They're absolutely, but they're delightful. They're unlike most of the manuscripts in this part of the sale, in the sale number one. They are illuminated. That is, they are illustrated with pictures. And they really are, they're two really beautiful items. They're miniatures on vellum. They're really precious objects is what they are. One is A Grace After Meals, and the other is a miniature book of prayers. They're really both almost certainly made for as bridal gifts. They're tiny, the half the size of maybe a sort of paperback in a way. But they're exquisite, and they date from the 18th century, and they are both written by important scribes of the period. And they are, shall we say, two of the more affordable things in sale number one. The miniature book of prayers is $80,000 to $120,000, and the Grace After Meals is $150,000 to $250,000.
What are some of the other treasures?
Well, we have two Samaritan Bibles. We have two Yemenite Bibles. Oh, these are all manuscript material, mm-hmm. quite early. We have a Franco-Prussian Bible, which is, again, very early. That dates from the 12th to the 13th century. We have... we represent Europe pretty well, actually, and the Middle East. We have a Bible from Italy, dated 1401, about $300,000 to $500,000 on that. It's the Psalms. And then we have an Iberian Bible, a Bible that came from Spain or Portugal, that's also obviously pre-expulsion, and really very beautiful, too.
What I find interesting in the manuscripts is, again, the calligraphy, so beautiful.
Well, these are the creators of these extraordinary books, of course, were professionals. I mean, they were professional scribes, and they really did do very, very beautiful work.
Now, you mentioned that you have two Samaritan Bibles. Are there any textual differences between the Samaritan Bibles and the traditional Jewish Bible?
There are indeed, but it's not for me to really go into great detail about that.
I understand.
I'm not a scholar, but there are distinct differences, yes.
Okay, and we're just about out of time, unfortunately, because I find this absolutely fascinating. As I look around the room, I see some samples. Unfortunately, I can't show it over the radio, but I'm looking at truly incredible treasures.
Well, your audience is completely invited to come to Sotheby's. The exhibition opens on December the 16th and will be open until the sale on the 22nd of December. So, people can come and look at these then very carefully. And we will also put on view at the same time, I think, a small selection of other material from the Valmadonna Library, which will be, coming up for sale next year. And then also I should add that at the same time that exhibition takes place, there will also be an exhibition of Judaica from what we call our various owners sale. So there'll be a great deal of Judaica actually on view, not just these 12 items. There'll be hundreds of items on view because there'll be a large sale that coincides with the sale, take place the same day after the sale is over. There are two different sales. There's an Israeli art sale, although that actually will be happening a few days earlier, and then a Judaica sale, which consists of primarily books and manuscripts, but also ceremonial objects, mm-hmm. In silver, and there's fabric, and so forth. And also, in that sale, some paintings too, by various 19th century and 18th century artists, really primarily from Europe.
Very good. Thank you very, very much. And I hope that before the actual auction, we'll get another chance to speak to you.
I look forward to that very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. And tune us in next week, right here on Black Dog Radio, The Kosher Scene, and look at our blog, kosherscene.wordpress.com. Thank you very much. Good night, one and all.